Next case this afternoon is Jones versus McDonald Farms. I know the students are leaving. I assume the bus is here, so thank you for joining us. We'll let them clear and then we can proceed. When you're ready.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Andy Berry. I represent the appellant in this case, Diane Jones. The question in this case is whether Nebraska law provides a remedy to a minority shareholder when the majority shareholders of a corporation have managed that corporation for their sole benefit, while at the same time denying the minority shareholder any financial return on her share in the corporation. The answer to this question is yes. The law does provide a remedy. It protects the rights of minority shareholders to be treated fairly and to share proportionately in the gains of the corporation. The case that best articulates this principle is the Bauer Farms decision that's cited in our brief. The Bauer Farms case holds that it is oppressive for majority shareholders if the corporation has the resources to refuse to pay dividends to a minority shareholder while at the same time refusing repeated requests to sell shares for fair value. And
if I recall correctly, Bauer's an Iowa case, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think what ultimately the court concluded in that case, I can't remember if it, maybe it had been decided on summary judgment and the court reversed it, and there was a deferred, at least it reversed it, saying that there needed to be a determination as to whether or not the formula provided for in the articles was fair in terms of the price for purchasing the shares.
I think that was part of Bauer Farms. So there was a buy-sell agreement in Bauer Farms, just as there's a buy-sell agreement in this case. But there was also a history of dividends not being paid.
20 years worth, right?
It was a longer history, and we can get into that issue as well, and I will address that, Your Honor. But the basic legal standard set forth in Bauer Farms is consistent with the standards in every other state that is whose decision I've read in preparing for this case. The standard was I think applied, or at least it was adopted. I don't think it was applied correctly, but it was adopted by the district court. The appellee doesn't cite any different standard in this case, doesn't articulate any other different standard for judging corporate oppression. And in this case, we have a very clear record that no dividends were paid, that the corporation had the ability to pay dividends. It was generating tremendous amounts of revenue over and above even its ordinary operating expenses, then it was going out making extraordinary purchases of property, and still there was significant money that was left that was available to pay dividends. No dividends were paid. And the appellant, Diane Jones, did make repeated requests to sell her shares for fair value. Well, actually, it was far less than fair value. So when
but
Diane Jones...
the articles...
What's that?
What do the articles say as far as that... price to be paid upon that?
The articles talk about book value, mm-hmm. Your Honor, but book value isn't necessarily fair value. So,
but is there anything that requires fair value if the articles, I mean, don't we enforce the articles as written?
Well, the Anderson Bellino versus Bellino case says that's not necessarily the case. So Anderson versus Bellino says that if there's inequitable conduct of some kind, then equity will devise a remedy. And Anderson versus Bellino, the situation was that the majority shareholder was treating the corporation essentially as an alter ego of itself. Now, there's evidence of that in this case. There's a long history of not holding shareholder meetings. And if you look at pages 180 to 188 of the record, Randy McDonald gave a good description of the way that McDonald Farms fits into the overall strategy for Randy and Don and their families to maximize their income and minimize their taxes, while at the same time ignoring the interests of the minority shareholders. That's part of it. But also we have the distributions of commodity wages that are made. So I think under Anderson-Bellino, it's clear that that provision under the buy-sell agreement doesn't prohibit a court from looking to fair value being something other than book value. And I think that if you look at the cases that are cited in our brief, it's clear that that fair value is related to the fair market value, not book value.
Moltson testified, I believe, that all of the activities that Donald and Randall engaged in were basically tax strategies.
Right.
Right? Can we find anything? Do we have to find something inherently wrong with that before we can grant your client any relief?
No. And in fact, if you look at a case, I'll give you one example in our brief. The In Re White case is a case decided from the bankruptcy court in Texas, but it was removed. Started in state court, and it went into bankruptcy court as a result of one of the defendants filing bankruptcy. That's the case where the court said, look, what the owners of this corporation did makes sense from a tax standpoint. And by the way, it's essentially what was going on in this case. It makes sense from a tax standpoint, but it's not fair to the minority shareholder. And under these circumstances, that's oppressive, and the courts will provide a remedy.
In that case, do you recall if the minority shareholder had purchased its share?
I believe there was a purchase in that case, Your Honor.
And in this case, it's not purchased.
That's right. I don't think that should make a difference. I mean, this is property that Diane Jones owns. And I guess I'm not aware of any case that would hold that a share that's inherited is worth less, or that the shareholders have fewer rights than shares of stock that the shareholder purchases. I'm just not aware of any case law that would hold that. And if Diane's mother wanted to give her something of value, you know, it includes her rights as a shareholder under the Nebraska Business Corporations Act.
Which brings me, I want to ask you, in your brief, you're critical of the transfer of stock to the two boys.
Right.
Because under the articles that were supposed to be offered first to the corporation.
Right.
Would that same principle not apply to Betty's devise of the shares?
It doesn't, Your Honor. This was never an issue at the trial. But if you look at the language of the articles of incorporation on this point, it's at least ambiguous into the articles as to whether they would apply to a inheritance. There's some language in there that talks about an executor or a personal representative. I can't remember the precise language that's used. But in their two Penfield Oil cases decided by the Nebraska Supreme Court, in the first one, Justice Girard refers to the principle that shares that are inherited, that's not necessarily affected by a buy-sell agreement. So that was never an issue, but I don't think that, and everyone agrees that Diane Jones is a 7 1/8% shareholder in this corporation. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time
sure.
for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Dan Plotzik, and I'm from Grand Island, and I represent the defendants in this case. The plaintiff in this case appeals from the decision rendered by Judge Rachel Doherty. It was a case tried over 5 days. The bill of exceptions is 900 pages long, and Judge Doherty rendered a 20-page opinion. So she went through the evidence and considered the evidence. And when you read the brief and when you look at the evidence, what the plaintiff's case consisted of is a broad brush that merely alleges conclusions, alleges oppression. So what we did through the evidence was try to establish that, no, in fact, there is not oppression. And Judge Reedman, when you asked about what the brother's actions, was it just done for tax purposes? And the answer is no, it was not done just for tax purposes, because if you look at the assets that were purchased, well, one of them, two of them, were purchased in 2009, the grain dryer and the grain lathe. That was before she even became a shareholder. And I think the testimony was that it was rusting out and it needed to be replaced.
But the testimony was also that they timed their purchases.
Sure.
So that they could never go beyond that $50,000.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with doing that.
Except that it leaves very little, if anything, for the minority shareholders.
It leaves very little, well, of course it does. They were the minority shareholders at that time, too, in 2009. Don and Randy were. And also, if you don't do it and time that to minimize your taxes, you're going to pay more in taxes. Then you're going to pay your dividends out. And then next year, when it's rusted out and it needs replacing, you're not going to have the cash to replace the asset.
Well, unless you ultimately end up with a couple $100,000 extra that you pay out in commodity wages.
Right, and that was also discussed in the trial. And we presented evidence that there, in fact, the only evidence offered established that those payments were reasonable. The plaintiff lawyer alleged that they were not reasonable, but presented no evidence to that effect. If you look at what the testimony was, they called a guy by the name of Scow, who purported to be a farm manager, but he was basically the office manager for a farm managing corporation. Scow testified that these guys are entitled to a management fee of 7.5% to 10% a year, and testified he had no opinion as to whether or not the amounts that they were paid in those 2 years was reasonable or not. The other guy, Rickert, was an appraiser, but he took into consideration an 8% management fee when he went through his income method of evaluating the value of the corporation's real estate. The only testimony and the only evidence offered was our evidence, and we had testimony by Randy, and we had testimony by the accountant, who both established the basis for paying those commodity wages, and they both testified that those amounts were reasonable. So there's no evidence that the payment of those commodity wages was oppressive or unreasonable. Yes, ma'am? Oh, I thought, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Didn't
mean
to put you on the spot. That's your job to put me on the spot. Okay.
Thanks.
The other thing we looked at, they complained of it. And this is an illustration of what was going on in this case. Because they complained of the net, the $50,000 every year. And they said, that's not fair. It shouldn't get it down to $50,000. Well, net income doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's the product of two things. It's the product of gross revenues minus expenses. So we looked at them both. And originally they said, those leases, those 50-50 crop share leases, those are improper. They're conflict of interest transaction, and so they should be avoided. So we had to go through all that and establish that this is a C corporation, not an S corporation. If it gets its money back in cash, it's seen as a holding company and pays loads of taxes. So it has to go through a crop share arrangement. So we offered evidence establishing that that is the norm for these kind of corporations. And then we looked at gross wages. And lo and behold, we found out that their guy, Scow, was comparing operating income to our corporation's net taxable income and not considering depreciation. And he admitted on cross-examination that to be a fair comparison, you have to add back in that depreciation when you consider McDonald Farms, my client's gross revenues. And when he did that, we found out that they were outperforming his company's clients. So that established that these guys are doing a wonderful job for McDonald Farms.
And they're doing a wonderful job for McDonald Farms, but aren't the two entities that are profiting from it the two entities owned by each of the brothers?
No. McDonald Farms... Remember, these guys worked for 36 years without getting any pay, which allowed McDonald Farms to borrow money in 1989 and 1990 to buy Free Farms at 10.5%. And Richter, their own appraiser, testified that those asset values had appreciated by millions of dollars. So by not taking any wages in those years, the profit went to the corporation because it now has an asset, or has three assets, three farms worth millions of dollars that wouldn't have existed had they taken their wages during those years and left McDonald Farms without the cash to buy those farms. So no, they're not the ones profiting. They're getting their 50% share, which is they're entitled to, but so is McDonald Farms. McDonald Farms, as a landlord, has to buy the pivots, it has to buy the EcoDrip system, it has to have grain storage because it takes grain and then it markets it. So that's all a use of cash, and it shares in the expenses of the corporation. And we offered hundreds of pages of documents that established that indeed they're only paying their, McDonald Farms is only paying its 50% share. So that's not an issue today.
So, go ahead. I do have a question now. Switching gears a little bit on the offer to sell her shares and the argument that the corporation's offer pursuant to the articles to pay book value was not fair or was somehow oppressive conduct. So I'd like you to address that.
Sure. She acquires her stock, and for eight, she acquires it in on December 22nd, 2011. 8 months pass and nothing happens. On August 20, 2012, she offers to sell her stock, and they don't reach an agreement. 7.5 months later, she files suit. So it's, you're talking about a period of 7.5 months that leads to her saying she's been oppressed and filing this lawsuit that was originally filed to dissolve the corporation. And there's nothing that establishes that a delay in purchasing stock over 7.5 months is in and of itself oppressive behavior. Well, that means I got 2 minutes. Okay. There was testimony in the record by Randy McDonald that they did offer more than book value at one point in time, and that's on page 352. But no testimony was fleshed out as to what that was or how much that amounted to or when that occurred. So there is no evidence establishing that the failure to reach an agreement is oppressive. And that's really what this lawsuit is all about, because they offered an appraisal dated June something of 2013 when commodity prices were at their peak. In an effort to force my clients to buy her stock at that value. And their appraiser admitted that the value of farm real estate is directly related to commodity prices, and that by the time he gave his testimony, those commodity prices had been cut in half. So it's clear that what this lawsuit was all about was an effort to exert pressure on McDonald Farms, Inc. and on my clients to buy her stock at an inflated value. And they didn't want to do it, frankly. And as it proved out, by the time of trial, commodity prices, as they thought would happen, had cratered, and so had farm land values. So the failure to buy her stock wasn't oppressive in this case. And I think in this case, there's been a broad brush that basically spends a lot of time making conclusory allegations against my clients. And what we did at trial was get into the facts behind those conclusory allegations, and we established that there was not oppressive conduct. And Judge Doherty considered those facts in detail over her decision, and we'd ask that you affirm her. Yes, ma'am.
Under what circumstances can Ms. Jones ever economically benefit?
You're asking me to speculate. And I can't comment on what's happened since trial because that's not in the record. So I can't let you know whether or not dividends are being paid or being considered. All I can do is point out in the record that both the accountants and Randy McDonald said that they would consider paying dividends in the future. However, 7% dividends aren't a lot of money. Okay, even 7% of, I'm not very good at math on this. Yeah, 7% of 50 grand isn't a lot of money. So, which leads you to the conclusion the purpose for this lawsuit wasn't to collect dividends, it was to force the sale of this stock at an inflated value.
But if the value of the land is millions of dollars, mm-hmm. and what she gets out of her stock ownership is only book value of $50,000, or the book value off of, you know, the formula that's in the articles, she's not getting much value out of that $1 million asset.
And that's the problem with the relief they're requesting on appeal. They're requesting that you remand this to order that we buy it, okay? At issue at trial wasn't whether that book value was the right formula or not. We didn't deal with that. We dealt with whether there was oppressive conduct. And there was not, and her decision was correct. So we ask that be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time do we take Mr. Plotzik over?
1 minute and 42 seconds.
And would you please add that to the rebuttal time of the appellant? Give him a moment to do the math.
Yeah. All right, that'll be 4 minutes and 29 seconds.
If you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Reedman, I want to address one of the points that you made about my client's ownership interest in this corporation. She owns 7 1/8% interest in a corporation that has somewhere between 1,000 and 1,100 acres. That's essentially 80 acres of land, of farmland. All of the income that's generated from that farmland goes to Randy and Don. None of it comes to her. That's the way that this is set up. And yes, part of the structure is a tax structure to keep taxes down. But of course, part of that also, the way the structure works, is that all of the income to the tenants, R&T Farms and DNLA Farms, that stays in the tenants, and they can do with that what they wish. And so that's compensation that Randy and Don have received all throughout the years. And actually, when Don testified at trial, he said, well, when we became officers of McDonald Farms, I didn't really see any difference between McDonald Farms and DNLA Farms. It's all part of the same thing. He had a very difficult time articulating what he does differently from one to the other, and that's because they really treat them all as the same thing. That's how Randy and Don receive their compensation. Diane isn't receiving anything. When it comes to the amount of the wages being reasonable, that's a factor that I think has to be considered. But a couple of other quick points. First, so today Mr. Plotzik has talked about taking what a farm manager would make. Well, first of all, there's no evidence that officers of corporations pay themselves what farm managers make. Even if that were the case, though, if you look at the math, well, second, Chris Scow said a farm manager is going to be independent. He's going to work for all the owners, not just some. And then even if you do the math, if you take that 8% and you multiply it over the income which the plaintiffs or which the defendants put on, and they have the burden of proof here, it doesn't add up. And we point that out in our brief. So it doesn't add up. And the other thing is, on that test of reasonable compensation, the main test is the Lynch case from Wyoming. And when the plaintiff or when the defendants cite that case, they leave out what I think is a critical factor, which is a comparison of the wages that are paid to the return on investment for shareholders. And of course, here the return on investment for shareholders is zero.
It's remarkable that we have to go to all these other states to find some law.
I think it is remarkable. I mean, it is remarkable. I think the one case that we do have in Nebraska is the Baker case. And if you look at the decision in Baker, that involved amounts that were far, far smaller than the amounts at issue in this case. And the court found that that could demonstrate oppression and a breach of fiduciary duty, though. When it comes to the timing, okay, there's a number of different factors here. How long does Diane have to wait? She's 61 years old. If you look at the Trierweiler case, and this is something that's not in our brief, and I apologize, I looked at this getting ready for the argument today. That case holds there's a 4-year statute of limitations on bringing a claim for minority shareholder oppression in Nebraska. Well, Diane didn't wait 4 years to bring a claim, and actually, she became a shareholder in 2011 and started asking Randy in January of 2012 about buying shares. So what, she didn't wait 8 months. But regardless of all of that, the oppression continued through the lawsuit. So if we have this 4-year statute of limitations, we can't have a rule that says you have to wait 20 years. And I come back to the White case, because the White case says, look, if there's a structure in place where there's an incentive, it's a strong incentive that says the owners, the majority shareholders and the officers have this incentive to pay themselves and exclude minority shareholders, that structure itself is oppressive and the court needs to deal with it now. That's what the White case says. The last thing that I would say is that if the court doesn't find oppression and breach of fiduciary duty on the record of this case, then its decision is going to provide a roadmap for majority shareholders all over Nebraska to say, well, we paid ourselves all the profits this year, but look, we think we were underpaid in prior years. And yes, we haven't come into court with evidence of what exactly we did, because that's not here, the hours that we worked, and we're asking for commission, but the income that we made that we can show in the record doesn't add up to the commission. But trust us, okay? That is a roadmap for oppression, and I don't think that this court should countenance that, and for that reason we ask that this court reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. You are excused, and the case is submitted. Which